Call the February 16th, 2000 session of the House Workforce and Economic Development Committee in session. We're going to have a public hearing and a work session on House Bill 2447 to begin with. And that's Representative Lin's Korean American Day. Are there any guests this morning that wish to testify on this bill? Public hearing. Seeing no one here for the public hearing, we'll close the public hearing and open the work session part of this bill. We have some dash two amendments to this bill. Ellen, if you could please give us a brief review of the amendments.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. The dash two amendments were drafted by legislative council in order to provide more clarity on the structure and purpose of the commission. And so accordingly, they expand the committee membership from 7 to 9 members. They require the election of a chair and a vice chair of the commission. They institute biannual reporting requirements. And it removes the provision requiring the commission to seek public and private involvement in order to address the issue that was discussed last time, which was the lack of a mechanism for the commission to account for financial donations. And then finally, there's a sunset clause that concludes the commission on January 2nd of 2016.
Any questions from the committee members for Ellen? Regarding the proposed amendments? Yes.
Thank you. If I understand the Section 3 correctly, after January 2nd, 2016, there will still be a Korean American Day on January 13th, but there will no longer be a commission.
Thank you, Chair Representative Barnhart. That is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Any further questions for Ellen? Seeing none, hearing none, Vice Chair Riley, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair, I move that we send this House Bill 2447. We're on the amendment.
Yes.
I move that we adopt the dash two amendment to House Bill 2447.
Thank you, Vice Chair Riley. To the motion, any discussion? Seeing none, hearing none, are there any objections to adopting the dash two amendments to House Bill 2447? Seeing, hearing none, they are adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we pass House Bill 2447 to the full House for and with a due pass recommendation.
That is with amendments,
with amendments, yes.
Thank you. Vice Chair Riley moves House Bill 2447 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions or comments on that motion? Seeing none. Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Dell?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lim?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. Having received the majority vote, House Bill 2447 as amended is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much. Vice Chair Lim, would you like to carry this bill?
It will be my great honor.
Thank you very much.
At the same time, can I request that maybe we could carry it together?
That would be a great honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. Representative Dolan.
Nothing. You handled it. I was thinking perhaps the consent agenda, but it's not appropriate.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And with that, Chair recognizes that we have some guests in the audience who might like to have a photograph here of the committee. And with that, we're going to stand in recess here for 5 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Right here by the wall?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to be in the back.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're going to be in the front.
I'm going to be in the front.
Come on in here.
Chair Witt, you shouldn't let her stay out of it.
Barry?
You're going to have to come on, too.
Come on, Barry.
Okay.
You don't want your...
I want to know how tall
you are. Yes, I want.
Okay, you got it?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
John, somebody stole your chair.
You'll never forgive me for that now.
Okay.
I think you said 5 minutes, so we get a little more time.
Yeah.
And the correct for us, just a major conversation. I will be carrying this bill, the 2447, when it's passed, that the 22nd, which is next week, Thursday, and plus other bills, HJR 12. And I'm going to carry these two bills to Korea. And we are planning to expand nationwide. And then hopefully January 13 will be the worldwide Korea Day. So this is a good start from this chamber here. I do appreciate it. Ellen also helping us in this matter. Thank you.
Congratulations, Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you.
Well, by committee time, we're getting close to our 5 minute recess here. So we will. We're back on the record here. We are next going to have a public hearing on House Bill 2206. And before we call up our first panel, I'd like to set the stage a little bit for some of the panel discussion that we're going to have. In our last session on Wednesday, Vice Chair Lim had a series of comments and discussion revolving essentially around the vast number of programs that we have to deal with individuals who are unemployed and may need skill upgrades. I think it's fair to say that there was perhaps a desire to attempt to try and collapse some of those programs and reduce some of the silos and some of the overhead costs. We've also had extensive discussion with a number of witnesses from various industries and clusters and sectors that have appeared before this committee. Who have described to us in various fashions what they see as the importance of bringing professional technical education back into our school systems with an emphasis on developing careers for those students who may not be headed for a college, probably the 70% of our students that are in school. All of this aimed at attempting to diminish the impact of what I've casually referred to as the lost decade, where a number of our students, after they graduate from high school, for the lack of a better term, bang around for a decade in various jobs until they find the final career that's their final career path. We've also heard a great deal about the importance of apprenticeship in terms of assisting in this process and how it can early on lead to development and career paths. And I know that Representative Holby and Representative Dahlem have been very active members of this committee in pursuit of those particular goals. I've asked for representatives of both the Bureau of Labor and Industries as well as our education department, to please make themselves available this morning so that our committee could express some of these interests and concerns to them. I think I have a sense from our committee that the Skill Up bill is a very critical bill in terms of being able to deal with people whose skill capacity doesn't meet the needs of prospective employers. With that said, based on both the testimony and the interests of our committee, there has been a broad concern among the committee members that we could spend money forever trying to deal with the folks that don't have the skills and never address the root problem. And with that, having had a discussion with Representative Riley, he captured that perfectly for me the other day. And Representative Riley, could you describe some of the things that we talked about, please?
Sure. Basically, the discussion, as the chair has mentioned, centered around whether or not we want to attack the result of not having the programs in place that actually create a good workforce, and or if we want to actually attack the root problem. And basically what was said was, if we don't solve the problem, we'll be attacking the solution forever. And the results of not attacking the problem are much worse than attacking the result of not having that solution. So, in a nutshell, we felt that it's very important to start with the folks who are going to be a problem later if we don't do something now, as opposed to dealing with the folks who have already become part of that problem.
Thank you, Vice Chair Riley. And with that, I'd like to call up, is Salam Noor here this morning? Yes. Sir, would you please come forward? And Commissioner Dan Gardner, if you come forward too. And I don't know if any of you have additional folks that you brought with you this morning, but welcome and good morning. I think as Vice Chair Riley laid out for us, there is an interest in among our committee members in trying to emphasize professional technical education in our schools, first to have the program, and then secondly to make students knowledgeable about the skilled crafts and trades. And with that, Commissioner Gardner, could you address what from your perspective, the importance you see in professional technical education?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I think you've really struck it on the head here, is that there is a tremendous need out there in professional and technical areas. You know, the average age right now of a construction worker is 48 years of age. In some ways, I'm sad to say I am the average age of a construction worker. You know, it beats the alternatives, but, you know, it's never fun getting older. Anyway, bottom line is that as the baby boomers tend to retire, there is a tremendous and vast gap and need. AARP will tell you right now that 10,000 Americans a day are turning 50 and have been for the last 10 years and will for the next 3 or 4. At the same time, we have a situation in the state where the chair aptly put it, only 28% of students actually will graduate from high school and go on and get a 4-year college education. And we're in all the economic downturns that we've been having over the last decade, cutting dramatically out vocational and technical training throughout the state in various different schools. I know I tour a lot of the different school districts and go through different technical training, their training programs and tour them. In Springfield, for instance, they only have one of 14 auto shop classes that are left in the state out of 200 school districts, or nearly 200 school districts. And what we've got actually in for a program in the governor's recommended budget, one of the ways we address it, we've got 26 different training facilities around the state. One of the hardest things for a school district to do is to invest in all that equipment that they need for those vocational and technical training programs. In order to invest in those and upkeep that equipment, it can run, you know, for each school virtually in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. But yet we have 26 of these training facilities around the state, including 9 on community college campuses, where most of them are not used during the day. And what we're trying to do with one of our policy option packages is accomplish two things. One is to match up those school districts with those vocational and technical training programs so we can, you know, put those shop classes, if you will, those technical training classes back in place and show young people the opportunities that are out there. I mean, the average apprentice makes around $39,000 a year. And that's very good money. These are high-skilled, high-paid professions with health care and retirement in most cases. And so our program would replicate that, put it back into those schools, be able to use those vocational training facilities. Our policy option package calls for a pilot program, one rural, one urban, to show we can make this work over the next year. The other piece that this program asks for is, you know, guidance counselors in the schools have a tendency to push young people toward college, college, college. Yet, as we just said, 72% of those students, in fact, will not go on to college and graduate, and we've never been able to impact those numbers extremely dramatically. So we're underserving those. One of the things guidance counselors, as well as general teachers, have every year is continuing education courses in order to keep up their licensing, just as I do as a licensed electrician or other people do in other professions. We want to work on a program that will match up continuing education with those guidance counselors so we can bring them into those apprenticeship and training facilities and show them the math, the science, the skill, the wages, the hours, and the working conditions, to be quite honest, and help them to become advocates for those programs as well. And, Mr. Chair, I'd invite the committee, if you're more interested in apprenticeship and training, we have 26 of those facilities around the state, including some that aren't very far from this facility right here in Salem. I welcome you to go out and tour one. Even hold a committee hearing from an apprenticeship and training facility and see what they're like. Talk to some of the directors, you know, that absolutely dearly love what they do in educating young people into a profession that creates a family wage job and a living for them and themselves and their family for the rest of their lives. And I can say that from personal experience as a third generation electrician, where my grandfather, my father, and myself have all been through apprenticeship and training, and certainly worked in a profession that helped to create a living for our families.
Thank you very much. Questions for Commissioner Gardner? Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Commissioner, have you, I did some research on this particular model that you're talking about just a little bit, and I don't know if you're aware or if you've looked at what the state of Washington has done with a very similar program where they have had apprenticeship intersecting with the high schools. And it from everybody I've talked to in the state of Washington, this has just been a huge success at bringing people into the trades. And I guess what one of the things our committee has been hearing is, you know, of this train wreck that we're headed for, and I can speak from my participation in the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, where we have identified $300 billion worth of construction projects in the next 10 years in the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada. And everybody we've talked to in from these industries and from these fields, and even our economic gurus are saying, boy, if we don't get some people, you know, into this industry, into the construction industry, these projects are going to just sputter, and it's going to be a huge drag on our economy. So I guess where I'm headed with this is, you know, is a pilot project really going to, you know, I mean, it's great that we would do a pilot project and see how this works, but I believe there's a model in Washington right now that is very similar to this we could look at and see what kind of success it is. And I guess my question to you is, wouldn't it be better to actually put some money into this and to expand it beyond a one urban and one rural and really make an investment in this to get people into this more quickly instead of waiting another couple of biennia to take a look at this pilot project and say, you know, well, we've got a few more people into the trades when we're really looking at a major shortage of workers. I'm just wondering about the urgency of this need and whether, you know, a small pilot project is really the right answer for this legislature and this state.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hovey, I couldn't agree with you more that it is actually, as you phrase it, a train wreck, because one of the things any time a new business moving to the state that's going to, you know, or a business that's here that's going to grow and expand in the state, you know, looks at is how quick can I get my building done? Can I get it done, you know, in cost? Can I get it done without corrections? Can I, you know, get it done on time and get my product to market? And if we don't have the workforce in order to do that work, that you could well lose, you know, that construction, that work, and the jobs that follow along with it. We have looked at the state of Washington, and the very same question you asked, we were asked about 2 weeks ago from the Ways and Means Subcommittee where our budget bill's at. We have been putting together a program of what we could do with additional resources, and I'd be happy to share that with the committee. And actually, Steve Sims, my director of apprenticeship and training, can give you some of the details of that. There is a lot more we can do, and it does take those resources in order to make that happen. What is happening in the state of Washington with grant programs is actually working phenomenally well.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, You kind of answered my question a little bit, but I wanted to ask you. It seems to me that with the apprenticeship programs already in place, the buildings, the equipment, everything is sitting there, that this is a really economical way to go. And I wanted to get your sense of what kind of budget we really are talking about if we went much larger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Riley, to the current budget we're asking for in the governor's policy option package is roughly around $100,000. And in order to do it in a much larger scale, to have the FTE positions we would need and the people to disperse without the state, and the availability to do some of those very grant programs, the kind of budget we would be looking at, the numbers we just put together for the Ways and Means Subcommittee would be about $695,000. And with that, we can address tremendously more efforts across the state. We could end up, instead of two pilot projects, having several others out of those 26 facilities. We could also be working on grants through the Apprenticeship and Training Program, or Council, the Apprenticeship and Training Council, which is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate and I chair, where we could copy some of what Washington's doing and giving those grants to those apprenticeship and training centers that work closely with the schools to get that partnership going, to let those young people know of the opportunities that are out there. That's one of the biggest things we hear from young people is we don't know it exists. We have websites, we put out information, but yet still can't reach every single school district without resources and staff availability to do that.
Representative Bell.
Yes, Dan. When you and I were visiting in the office, I talked about another program. I want to ask you, would it be appropriate for us, because the training centers do exist, would it be appropriate for us to draft legislation that would say a student could attend the training center if the high school and the training center worked in cooperation? Our young man could come out of there, or young woman, pardon me, with several years towards an apprenticeship and a high school diploma. Can that arrangement be made?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, that actually, there would be no need to draft legislation on that. We can do that simply with agreements between the school district and the apprenticeship and training facility. You know, I think clearly if they're working with a young person and putting them through that facility, when they go and apply for the apprenticeship and training program, that gives them a leg up over those others who apply.
So the real rub then, the problem is that our students are unaware of this tremendous program that's available. And I might say in talking, now, Dan, I don't want to put any words in your mouth, but I want to be sure everybody here knows exactly what can happen. When a young person gets into the apprenticeship program, they don't pay for it, they get paid for it. And when they're out of the, and when they're all done with their apprenticeship, they're really eligible as journeys for about, $55,000 to $65,000, $70,000 a year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, you're absolutely correct. An apprenticeship and training program is one where you have a combination of in the classroom training and on the job training. And for the on the job training, you are paid, and you are paid a very good wage. Like I said earlier, the average wage for an apprenticeship, and that's conglomerating the different years together and coming up with an average. You may start out lower and end up higher, but the average is $39,000 a year. Most of those programs with health care and retirement, and there's a varying different level of different types of trades, but if you take the electrical apprenticeship training program I'm most familiar with, having been on all sides of the table in that one, as an apprentice, as an interviewer, and now as overseeing those programs for the state, what you end up with is a five-year education that you virtually could take that job anywhere in the country with you. You would earn an average in that profession in roughly $65,000 a year, slightly better, with health care and retirement, and you're given a five-year, $50,000 education at absolutely no cost to the apprentice. All they pick up is their books, the cost of their books.
And I want to ask one more question. An apprentice, could they start at the age of 16, 17?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, no, they could not. There are a lot of reasons for that. Some are insurance reasons, for one thing, but the minimum requirement is a high school or equivalent diploma and that you be 18 years of age or older.
If we started them early, then, and let's work in conjunction with the high school and put a person in your program junior, senior year, 16, 17, 18, 19, for those 2 years, they would get classroom training. What would that do to the apprenticeship if they went out of the classroom portion that's done in the training center and into an apprenticeship program? Would it cut the apprenticeship by a number of years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, that would be up to the individual Joint Apprenticeship and Training Council, but it certainly could be made an arrangement where they could cut a year or so off for that type of program. Other things we could do, too, is work with the oftentimes people want to look at direct entry, and I hesitate at direct entry because you don't want to mandate onto a system that's totally self-sustaining and paying for itself how they operate their system and give that free education and who they give it to. But what we could do is work with the apprenticeship and training facilities to see that they shave off maybe part of the first year or all of the first year, maybe even part of the second. It's up to the negotiations we'd have with them. But we clearly can work with the contractors to make sure that those young people can go out and be, for instance, the shop person, the parts person, in that particular, if you take an electrical contractor, in their actual office, so that they're the person driving the parts and tools out to the job, and have that aspect of the training and the interaction with the other apprentices and journey-level people as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dan. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Whit. In 1993, I had the privilege of serving in this body, and at that time, Representative Bob Shiprack was here, and he came before our committee. And this is not really a new problem. I think we saw even in 93 the problems that were coming down the road. And I asked him what he thought the solution to the problem was as far as getting funding for vocational and apprenticeship programs. And I think the answer that he gave was tying a percentage of the budget of both education and community college to those different programs. Do you think such a do you think that would be a solution that might be a possibility?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Grodd, that is certainly a possibility. It's not something I've spent a lot of time looking at or thinking about. I know that there currently is not an awful lot of government dollars going into apprenticeship and training facilities at all. And I think any time you inject more money into a system, you cannot, that already operates, you can't help but improve and expand it. So it's certainly a possibility.
Please.
Just a follow-up, but vocational training, like in K through 12, seems to me would lead to an apprenticeship program. So if, for example, we set a certain amount of money, or a certain percentage of the budget, which is going to be over $6 million, to a vocational training, that would hopefully lead to more people, and then a percentage set aside in the community college budgets for apprentice programs, that would kind of open the floodgate a little bit and help solve the problem. To me, a lot of this is a financial problem and an allocation of resource problem.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Grodd, it is a resource problem and an allocation problem. There's no doubt that you don't put money into vocational technical. I would just hate to see, I'd love to see additional resources put in that area, not resources taken away from another area. I would hate to see, as a father and a parent of two children in the public school system, you see their classroom sizes rise for the addition of vocational, technical. It's a matter of being able to do both, not taking one away from the other.
Thank you very much. Salam, I think you've heard some of the interests here of our committee. Anything that you could assist us with in telling us how we might get to where we'd like to be?
Absolutely. Chair Whit, members of the committee, for the record, Salam Noor from the Department of Education, and with me is Colleen Milam, and hopefully between the two of us we can share information with you and answer all of your questions. Before I go any further, I just want to say that Superintendent Castillo regrets not being able to be here with you today. She has a great deal of interest in this topic and shares the same concerns that were just expressed by Commissioner Gardner and the ones we've been discussing. We provided you with a packet of information, and I apologize for not getting that to you sooner. We were notified yesterday that you wanted information, so we pulled it together, and we will be happy to come back and discuss it further with you after you had a chance to review it and reflect on it. But if I may go over the packet with you very quickly and then address some comments pertinent to the discussion. We have seven items in your packet. One is really sort of a quick overview of Oregon secondary profession technical education. And when we talk about secondary PTE in Oregon, we refer to programs that exist from grade 7 through 12. Although many of these programs are coordinated 7 through 14 into community colleges. The second document shows you the organization of these programs, and they tend to cluster around six career areas. Those six career areas were developed with teachers and practitioners from around the state, and they are agricultural, food, and natural resources systems, arts, information, and communication, business and management, health services, human resources, industrial and engineering systems, and they essentially encompass all of the careers and occupations that we have in the state and also represented nationally. The second document also shows you enrollment trends in these courses and programs at the secondary level. The third document shows you a quality criteria that we use to approve these programs at the state level, and the fourth document talks about the community college quality criteria. Since many of these programs are funded using federal funds, we are required to develop a quality assurance process that ensures that they have the appropriate skills, both academic and technical skills, as part of the student's learning experience. And on the community college side, the fourth document, the State Board of Education actually approves these programs to ensure that they meet a certain quality criteria. The fifth document lists the number of community college programs, both certificate programs and Associate of Applied Science degree programs, and I believe Commissioner Brawley will be sharing some information with you later, and she can address that as well. The sixth document is one of the most recent developments in our education system. The board took action on new diploma requirements last month. And as you are probably aware, professional technical education has always been an elective that's available for students in schools and districts throughout the state. By the board's action last month, professional technical education was moved into a required category, which I think will help accomplish some of the objectives that you have as a committee relative to having availability and access to quality professional technical education programs and experiences at the secondary level, and we're very excited about that. The last document is a summary of the Carl D. Perkins Career and Technical Education Act. This is a federal act that brings in about $28 million a year, $28 million per biennium that goes directly to schools and colleges around the state to develop and offer career and technical education programs for students to access in both secondary schools and community colleges. I apologize, it's a lot of information that we have provided you, but the intent was to share with you what's actually available at the secondary level and the community college level. We certainly share the same concerns that you have and the ones that Commissioner Gardner expressed. There is a problem. There really aren't enough programs to accommodate the level of interest. We have seen over the past 10 years in particular a diminishing of the number of programs available to students as a result of budget cuts both at the state and the federal level. The emphasis on academic student achievement, if you will, has caused many schools to redirect their resources to offer more math and science and language arts, which is very appropriate because we want our students to graduate from high school having those skills so they are successful in that post-secondary experience. And as you look at workforce preparation as well, there are reports at the national level that basically testify to the fact that when you look at career training and academic training, the skill sets are essentially the same, and students need to be prepared to a fairly high level to be competitive and to succeed in an apprenticeship program, for example. However, we've seen schools and districts adopt different models to deliver career and technical education in the state. I don't know if you're familiar with the Center for Advanced Learning. It's a partnership of five school districts with Mount Hood Community College that basically was designed to address the problem that you're concerned about, lack of available courses and programs at the secondary level, diminishing resources. The school superintendents came together in partnership with Mount Hood Community College, pulled their resources, and felt that they can accommodate students at a single facility rather than having to duplicate programs at every school and district. And that program seems to be very successful. It's very high-end. It's one that ties directly, I believe, to apprenticeship programs, and students would be prepared to leave that program and enter an apprenticeship program or pursue further education at a community college or university. We've seen additional creative programs. For example, in Polk County, several school districts have come together to address this problem, recognizing that they don't have the facilities or the capacity to offer programs that tend to be high-cost programs, if you will. So they've pulled their resources, they've worked out the transportation arrangements between schools and districts, they've aligned their course schedules, their school schedules and calendars, and managed to offer advanced technology courses and programs for students, whether at Dallas or Newburgh or some of these other schools in that area. So we're seeing a lot of different innovative approaches, but I will share with you that I think we need more. We need to create those opportunities for students. The partnership with BOLI and having those joint apprenticeship and training centers available for students to access and receive high-quality training is one of those creative options, and we're working with BOLI to facilitate that pilot. So I think we share your problem. We share the concerns that you have. And I believe there are creative models and solutions that can be looked at to allow students to enter an apprenticeship program early on while they're in high school, or looking at different models to deliver professional technical education in our state. In the 0305 session, I believe Senate Bill 272 was established. $49,000 were put into that bill to allow those types of solutions to emerge. The Center for Advanced Learning benefited from that opportunity. That Senate bill was revised in the last session. I think it was Senate Bill 80 with some changes in the language. But it was a mechanism. What I would say is that it's an existing mechanism that allows for different ways to deliver professional technical education in our state. Many of you are familiar with the Sabin Schellenberg Skill Center. That's another model to deliver a career technical education.
Thank you very much. Representative Lim, I think I skipped over you the last time. For that, I apologize.
Thank you, Dan. Commissioner Gardner, glad to see you here. I have some questions concerning while we need professional and skilled workers in our state. Last week, we heard a testimony that when the young people applied for the apprenticeship program of electrician plumbing, out of five, only one person can get it. So it seems to me a lot of applicants there, but we were not able to utilize them. It seems to me there's a big gap there. And another question I'd like to pose to you. Currently, we have about one out of four high school students dropping out. And most of the program we have in here today require at least a high school diploma or equivalent. What happened to those people who cannot make it? You know, we have a program, this is the requirement, you must pass this requirement to get in here, but some people simply cannot. But they are capable to do something else. You know, do we have any program to help those people who dropped out? Because we just cannot allow one out of four young people, because they don't have a high school or equivalent diploma, you know, they are not able to find a good job. And this is a big problem. I'd like to hear some of your opinions on this matter.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, I mean, your first question was about, percentage of young people being taken. And we have currently over 7,000 apprentices in 80-some-odd different crafts across the state. And as I said earlier, we've got the graying of America, and over the next few years we're going to have more and more retirement, so that 7,000 is projected to grow and balloon over the next 10 years incrementally every single year. So we'll see more opportunities out there. The thing is that what the apprenticeship training facilities, what their joint apprenticeship training councils are looking for is skilled applicants with that hands-on skilled training. And I think that as those opportunities grow and as we create more and more programs to give them that hands-on skilled training, then there'll be more that are taken in.
Okay. Chairwitt, Representative Lim. I think that's really a great question. I'd like to address with you very briefly the causes for students dropping out of school. And we do a dropout study on an annual basis, and although there is a long list of reasons why students drop out of school, primarily it's due to lack of engagement and lack of opportunities that really meet their needs, their interests, that gets them excited about coming to school. Quite often it's a credit deficiency when a student accumulates so many F's, if you will, or they don't have the necessary credits and they pile up and they can't graduate. They get very disillusioned, very disfranchised, and they decide to drop out of school. There is a host of other issues that contribute to that. Schools are very aware of this problem and I believe have taken a number of steps to address it. Most schools offer alternative education programs that look to recapture those students, bring them back into the alternative programs, and in many cases bring them back into their home high school to bring them back into the normal experience that they would typically have in a mainstream school program rather than an alternative school program. What I will share with you, though, is that many of our alternative programs are becoming very much mainstream, because because they're offering some very exciting and hands-on experiences for students that lead to engagement and lead to retention and completion of high school. Some of these alternative programs are in partnership with community colleges and other private providers around the state, and they're specifically designed to meet the needs of that population that are at risk of dropping out. Senate Bill 300 from the last session, the expanded options, was also designed to address this problem and allow students to actually earn college credit while in high school, because many of our dropouts seem to actually excel in an environment other than their home high school. Many of them participate in community college alternative education programs, and they are very successful, and we see a tremendous rise in their academic achievement as well, and they complete high schools. Many high schools are making the GED option available to students while in high school because that's an appropriate option for them due to family circumstances, if they have to work or if they have to support their families as a result of financial hardship or something to that effect. So schools are doing everything they possibly can to accommodate that population. What's really critical is addressing that problem before it actually occurs. So having more professional technical education programs, hands-on types of experiences at the high school will engage students. I mean, we've seen evidence that really leads to student engagement, to student retention. Just like athletics makes students excited to come to school, I believe those hands-on experiences get students excited about coming to school. And we have data that demonstrates very clearly that students in career and technical education programs at the secondary level have a very high academic achievement level compared to their peers. And quite often, especially because of the advanced level PTE, you see me switching back and forth between PTE and CTE. Professional technical education is how we refer to vocational education in Oregon. At the national level, the language has changed, and now it's called career and technical education. So I'm still in between both worlds, if you will, but it's the same thing. But we have data in all of the career areas that we provided you, and the documents show that clearly illustrates that students that are taking professional technical education courses, especially the advanced courses, tend to do very well academically. In fact, they perform at a higher level to their peers, and that's due to the nature of those courses. They tend to be very highly technical, highly advanced academically, and require a great deal of critical thinking and application, which are much more rigorous set of skills than just traditional academics. I hope that answers your questions.
Thank
Representative
you.
Lim.
Before I take additional questions, Colleen, did you have a statement today?
Actually, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. I'm here to answer questions, if I can, concerning professional technical education. I think one comment I would make, building on Salam's remarks, as we look at overall education and specifically professional technical education, really identifying what are the academic knowledge and skills that exist within a professional technical education area, and more clearly articulating that and what level of performance. So that is one major priority in terms of our future work, is getting clearer about that and working with our business partners to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I'm going to take a step back to House Bill 2206, and, you know, I'm glad that Cam got back into the room for this. So, you know, one of the issues that came up, and as I'm listening to this dialogue about professional technical education and apprenticeship programs, and we've spoke previously on this bill, we had a reference to the funds of the Skill Up Oregon program being contracted with regionally accredited education programs. And it popped into my mind that sounded like it may exclude apprenticeship programs. And so Cam Pruth really came to my office along with Lita Colligan, and we tried to talk about how we can include those in this Skill Up Oregon program, and whether, and I'm not even sure whether the apprenticeship programs would want access to these kinds of funds through the Skill Up Oregon, or maybe not, or whether they would want workforce development dollars as a trained provider or a training provider. I guess part of my problem with listening to all this and how we have to integrate apprenticeship and skills in with our education system, and the community colleges are playing a huge role in this as well, because they offer a slightly different kind of training, because the apprenticeship programs are usually based on our economy. There's only so many apprentices you can put out on the job site in a given economy. And the community colleges can offer training to anybody who wants it to provide them skills. You know, usually they pay for that themselves, though. But one of the issues that I see is that as this bill was drawing out, it seemed to exclude the professional technical training offered through apprenticeship programs because they're not accredited education providers. And for instance, somebody that went through an apprenticeship program can get a tremendous education and tremendous skills, yet none of those are accredited, and they can't use those to get, credit, at the college levels unless they get it through the college. And so I'm wondering how our community college, our education system, and our apprenticeship models can work closer together so that they recognize and the whole system is accredited, and can, whereas an apprentice who spends 4 years in an apprenticeship program can actually, you know, end up with credit towards a degree, which I don't know that that exists right now. And so, you know, I guess that's a big question in my mind, or I don't know if it really came out quite right, but I guess my question is how can we integrate the professional, technical, and apprenticeship programs? Because it's all education about our future workforce. Should they be accredited or should they not be accredited? Or should they have access to the same training dollars through workforce development that other programs get? You know, I guess I just throw that out. I'm not sure if that exactly made sense, but it seems like we have an apprenticeship model that needs to skill people up, but they're not really in the same educational system. And how do we have a synergy between those two so they work together better?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, not quite sure where to start with that one, but I think basically to...
I wasn't sure where to start.
I think really that my understanding, it's probably better to ask the community college people about the Skills Up program, but my understanding of the program is really to give people who are really at the lower end, very low skilled, some of the skills where they could get into an apprenticeship and training program, rather than actually apprenticeship training, is the goal of this particular bill and you know, as my understanding of this particular program. Could the community colleges, workforce development, education, and apprenticeship and training work better, flow better, and streamline together better? And absolutely, no doubt about it, we certainly could. And I think that, you know, for my part, we're more than willing to work with all parties. We've been working with the Department of Education currently on a couple of pilot programs we're working on. We're happy to work with anyone to make sure that the job gets done.
Representative Dahl.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative Bogey?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank just and maybe anybody can.
I may not get on now.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. My question was longer than the answer, I guess. But I guess you know, I was looking at, you know, and maybe Lita can answer this question later. You know, as the focus of the Skill Up program, is it really not aimed at the apprenticeship program, but aimed at the professional training that may be available at the high school level, or getting people, you know, oriented toward that skill level before they get to the apprenticeship level? You know, I guess that was a confusion on my part, and that's why I was concerned about this bill the way it was, the Dash 1 amendments were drafted, is because it didn't seem to have that synergy of the training providers that were outside of accredited education. And so either we need to make everybody accredited education, or we need to add them to this list to create a better synergy in providing a skilled workforce. I don't know where the focus of this Skill Up Oregon program is supposed to be, I suppose.
Thank you, Representative Holby. And actually, that's the purpose for this discussion here this morning, to make sure that, because the incumbent workforce is provided for in the bill, and a number of the committee members obviously have some other concerns that they would like to see addressed, and we're looking to you to give us that assurance that, in fact, when we take care of the incumbent workers with House Bill 2206, that in the same process we make sure that everyone else is taken care of as well. Representative Dahlem.
My question is to you and the last document. One of the things that I think, I want to put some things so you'll know where my question is coming from. Representative Girard talked about this problem in 1993. Put that piece of information up here. One of the things, when I first ran for the legislature, I had all of the answers for education. I've been here, this is my second session, I don't have any answers. But one thing I know in the legislature we can do is we can get in there and muck around in things. And then you have to put the pieces together. And we're just about to get in there and muck around. You can see it. Because we want desperately for... We had a report here that I think it was 700,000 jobs that we're going to need for in the skills. Pipe fitters, electricians, metal benders. It was horrendous. And those were not... jobs that those are jobs that will support Oregon, support families, and they're the very thing that this committee is trying to do. And it became apparent to us that the soft spot, and again, we're the committee and we're legislators and we have all kinds of people up here, but we could see that we were not getting the people into the trades that we wanted in the numbers we wanted. When you bring this sheet, it's a starting place. But remember now, we've been working on this since 1993. But it says professional and technical. This year, sophomores will have one credit of art, second language, or professional technical education. This year's freshmen will end up with two, and then the eighth graders, three. What will that look like on the ground, and what will that do so that Dan's technical programs see more high school kids? And I think wrapped up in there somewhere, I am going to question Representative Lem's figures. I think it's more like a third of our kids are leaving high school. So what is that those credits going to do to get more people into the trades, make more people aware of what's available? How will that look on the ground?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, I think we have evidence currently that students are taking professional technical education at a fairly high rate. Out of the 179,000 high school students that we have in the state, approximately 80,000 are enrolling in professional technical education programs. That varies from half a credit to actually two credits. In order to meet the federal requirements, students are categorized as a participant or a concentrator. A participant is a student that takes half a credit out of interest. A concentrator is one that takes an increased number of credits because they're interested in a career path. Many of them may actually be enrolled in a tech prep program that allows them to take two credits of professional technical education at the high school, connected and articulated with two credits of professional technical education at the community college level, if you will. So we know that there is a fairly significant number of students that are taking these courses right now in the elective category. And also, if I should share with you that the term professional technical education, as it appears on this document, that's a new term. It used to be actually applied arts. And applied arts is a very vague term. It's actually a dated term. It's no longer applicable to many of the courses and programs that are offered in schools today. So we purposefully changed it to professional technical education. So, and that's how I'm going to try and answer your question, Representative Dahlem, is that this becomes a much more visible category relative to a graduation requirement. And since it becomes part of the required category, schools and districts will pay greater attention to it, and we'll start to think about ways to offer programs and make them available to students, just like they have to offer programs in language arts, math and science, social studies, etc. This becomes a required course opportunity rather than an elective course opportunity. What we anticipate will happen is that schools that have the capacity to increase their course offering will do that because they have the resources available to do so. What we're seeing is really a trend for partnerships. Schools are coming together and saying, we don't need to duplicate the health services program that you have at this high school. How can we work together to provide access to these programs in a more unified and common way? So we're seeing them work with community colleges to provide access to programs that are available at the community college. We're seeing them work with business and industry to provide opportunities for students to access these programs that may be available in business and industry. I think you'll see an increase in enrollment and participation on the part of students because schools will make everything possible to make sure that those programs are available to students and to increase the access. What we need to do, I would suggest, is that we need to offer guidance to schools to be really deliberate and purposeful in terms of the types of programs that they offer, because these programs really need to coincide with the needs that the apprenticeship community has with industry and labor market trends in our state. So we want, if we see that health occupations are on the rise in the state, we know there will be a great need for them. So we want schools to pay attention to that and provide health services and health training opportunities for students rather than electives and offerings that don't really match the labor market trends and industry needs that we have. Without limiting the opportunities that are available to students, still students should have the option to explore and see what they're really interested in.
Follow-up. A couple of questions come to mind. We've gotten to, by this year's eighth graders and this year's seventh graders, three credits, but I don't think we've taken a direct attack, because when we can take arts, which would be drama, and arts, painting, that sort of thing, or second language, we could still, but we don't have a vehicle that says you must be involved in some vocational. It would seem to me, and again, I'm just educated enough to muck around in this, so. It would seem to me that if this is the last time we're going to see a student in vocational training, they all should have it. I mean, if they're going on to college and this is going to be the only taste they ever get of vocational training, they should have a shot. And if they're going into vocational training, they should have more. So being able to steer around this where you can do art or you could do language is not really, we can still have everybody in the state avoid vocational technical training with the system we have here. You can steer your way through the school and never see a hands-on program. And I think what we're concerned about, when you talk about a job shortage, on this panel we have heard doctor, lawyer, merchant, thief. Everybody's going to be shorthanded in 10 years. And I think we can all attest, I don't know why I chose that analogy. Where I'm going with this, two things that I dearly want to see, or I'm going to really get interested in mucking around in it, is that, one, the trades have a place at the table. I don't see them anywhere in the game, other than trying to catch as catch can. And I think that we have to have them at the table, and I think that we have to have some exposure to vocational training mandatory. And my promise is, I don't see that here. Well, what I see is an opportunity that can be avoided and probably will be avoided, is what I see. Is there a question in that? So will you dig a question?
Well, points well made, Representative Dahlem, and we'll just note that Representative Barnhart has two of your bases covered there. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, I think if I can surmise what you're trying to say, is you'd like a young person to be able to paint a picture, but be able to frame it and hang it on the wall, too.
Thank you, Dan. Yeah, well, that's exactly it. I mean, if this is the only chance they're going to get at it,
the
basic, simplest things. And if they leave that field, good.
Yeah.
But if they go into it, then we can work with other people. But thank you very much. Thank you for your patience.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been sitting here since I held my hand up and listening to all the other questions. I have a lot more, but I'll try to avoid some of those. First of all, I wanted to say in regard to the certification issue, I think you have to be careful what you ask for, because with certification comes some control, and I think that the apprenticeship programs being the self-directed, self-supporting entities that they are is probably a pretty good thing. The other issue I wanted to say something about was the avoidance of the professional technical. I think there are some folks who should be able to avoid that. If they know exactly where they're going to college, they have a major in mind, and that's where they want to go, they don't need to go into the shop. But finally, the one I really wanted to talk about was what Vice Chair Lim had brought up. We had a person in here, as he said, from the electrical apprenticeship in particular, and I know that traditionally, historically, one of the goals of the union trade apprenticeships is to control the amount of the number of people in the trade to coincide with the available jobs. And they've done a pretty good job of that. You look at the market, you see what's going to be available, and then try to control the entry into that trade so that there aren't a lot more people looking for those jobs that are available than there are jobs available. With the coming train wreck, when there won't be enough people to fill all the jobs that are available, is there capacity? As Vice Chair Lim pointed out, the person who was here said that they had 5 qualified applicants for each person that they chose to go into the apprenticeship in the electrical. Others may be different, but in that particular one, they had 5 qualified applicants for everyone chosen to be an apprentice. Is the capacity there, if the jobs are available, to take those other 4 people?
Mr. Chair, Representative, rather than me coming on a couple things. First, one of the things you said, be careful in the accreditation, what you asked for. I mean, that is very true. If the state were willing to pick up a significant portion of the apprenticeship and training, those costs and conditions and controls come along with it. I think that's why you see most private schools not really wanting the public money. However, on the other hand, doing as Washington has done, for instance, with a targeted pilot infusion of dollars to do a specific project is a different thing. And I would never suggest more than going beyond that point. The other thing, as far as capacity, while electrical in some apprenticeship and training facilities, which we have, I believe it's about 5 across the state at the moment. No, 6. Anyway, some are at the point where you're talking about where they're getting 5 qualified applicants for each one that they're taking in. That will not necessarily be the case as time goes on and they're needing more and more applicants. And with other skilled crafts, that's not true at all. They're not getting near that amount. Matter of fact, some of the problems I hear is they're not enough of what they like, the best and the brightest coming to them. And there's actually working on a few different things, one with Springfield School District and bringing the apprenticeship and training councils together with the school district to talk about their needs, because there are unique needs in the building and construction trades. For instance, if the school just teaches metric and you get out on the job site and they don't use metric, you better be able to add 7 3/4 and 8 5/8 in your head pretty fast to be able to calculate the rise in a cutting of stairs or whatever the application. But that's where we need the schools and those training centers working together to see that the young people have the skills that they need. Is there capacity there? In many facilities, there are. In some, there are not. If the demand is there, the capacity will meet those needs, though, is my belief.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm going to follow up, and I think I speak for quite a few people here, that I think the overall theme is that we really do want more vocational training, and we do want more apprenticeship programs, and I don't see a whole lot of dissension on this committee. But going back to vocational training, or if you want to call some things professional technical education, or Commissioner Gardner brought up the fact that auto mechanics, for example, is really pretty rare in schools. So the question for Salaam, what can we do to bring back such career things as wood shop, auto mechanics, and that sort of thing in K through 12? And actually, I think it's what Representative Dahlem says, that, you know, we're pretty frustrated with the fact that this seems to, if budgets get tough, these seem to be the programs that get cut. So we want something that's sustainable, and we want to make sure that people realize that we want those sort of programs in our educational system.
Chair Whip, Representative Gerard, I think that's really a great question, and I would say, would suggest that the answer is in creative solutions, because auto mechanic programs, manufacturing programs, health services programs, et cetera, are very cost intensive, and I believe that many schools were forced to cut those programs because they were not able to keep up with the technology that's so prevalent and so fast, if you will, in many of these programs. In the automotive field, for example, it doesn't make any sense to train kids on rebuilding carburetors when you have highly sophisticated fuel-injected engines. I can't even begin to describe them. So schools were not able to keep up with the technology. Therefore, they were forced to cut these programs or look for alternative ways to train students. The reason I suggest partnership is because that allows different partners, whether in K-12 community colleges or the business and private sector apprenticeship community in general, to come together and collaborate on finding solutions that work for everyone. And that may mean accessing automotive training shops at apprenticeship training facilities or at dealerships, if you will. And that's what I really would like to stress to you, is that whatever legislation you craft, you make partnerships as a vehicle that brings these different entities together, to think together, to work together, to problem solve together, with an emphasis on the student that we're trying to serve, whether that is a high school student, a community college student, or an adult that's 28 years old and decides to come back and wants to be an electrician or a carpenter. I think that was the heart of Senate Bill 80 and 272. I think it was the Skill Centers Bill. And that's what really made it so powerful, is that it called on these different entities to come together and craft solutions together. These programs, the reason we're not seeing many of them, because they are resource intensive, and schools just don't have enough resources to offer a full range of academic opportunities and a full range of career and technical education opportunities. Many small schools in rural areas in particular are very challenged to get traditional academic teachers. They're going to be equally, if not even more, challenged to get teachers in natural resources, in business and management, in industrial and engineering, in automotive. And there really isn't enough of a supply, quite frankly, of teachers in these fields, because many of the post-secondary institutions, the university institutions in particular, do not have vocational training programs to train teachers and certify teachers. Oregon State University is one of the remaining institutions that offer trainings in agricultural science, for example. So we have a problem that's compounded by a supply issue in terms of qualified teachers, trainers, and also resources. I want to share with you a couple of things that might help mitigate some of these issues that you're discussing today. One is our comprehensive guidance and counseling program in the state of Oregon, which is really touted as a national model, because typically guidance and counseling programs tend to focus on academic guidance, academic counseling to help students decide which colleges or which post-secondary institution they want to go to. our model is based on the National Career Development Framework, but we've expanded that and have taken it a step further. And within that model, and we're training counselors to use it now in schools, it focuses on three elements of a student's development. One is career development, the other one is academic development, and the third is personal development, and how do you actually bring them together. But career guidance and counseling is a big part of that. So we're training counselors to work with students to look beyond the college of choice or the college that they're going to and to look at, you know, different opportunities that may be available to them as direct entry to the workforce in conjunction with college or apprenticeship training programs, as an example. And we have a lot more work to do. We're just scratching the surface in that area.
Salam, I'm going to have to, if you'd excuse me, I'm going to have to interrupt and speed this up because we have a number of witnesses who are going to want to testify here today. Thank you very much for your depth of detail, but I am going to have to cut this short. Final question from Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass.
Okay. Panel, thank you very, very much. Before you leave, I think you get the feel from our committee that we're going to try and take care of the incumbent workforce through House Bill 2206, but we're going to need an assurance from all of you that as we continue our committee's work on the verge of that professional technical term, mucking, that we're going to need your assurance that we can rely on the fact that our developing workforce is going to have access to the kinds of professional and technical education that I think you've heard our committee express here today.
Thank you
very much. Appreciate
that.
With that, we're going to go directly to the essence of House Bill 2206, and I'm going to be calling up some panels here to try and expedite this process. If we could please have Duncan Wise and Norm Eder, please come forward. Gentlemen, I appreciate your patience here, but it was critical for our committee to be able to assure that we've taken care of all aspects of the workforce.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Duncan Wise. I'm a member of the State Board of Education, and I have listened with great interest to the discussion this morning. And I sort of I want to speak to 2206 and favorably towards it, but just a few brief remarks on the larger topic that you've raised, which is very near and dear to my heart. Representative Riley asked the question: if we had a well-run system that provided the standards and skills at all levels as students went through it, the problem we're facing today might not be nearly as serious as it is. And I completely agree with that. And that is why when I was before you earlier speaking on the need to redesign the education continuum pre-K through 20 with an aim of 40% of adults having a college degree, another 40% having a professional technical associate degree, a meaningful credential, is absolutely critical. And that's got to be your vision, and we've got to redesign the system to do that. And it's going to require a new curriculum. It's going to require a data system and a new budget system to help you get there. And
Duncan, if I could interrupt, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The vision is wonderful. Can you do it with existing funding?
Chair, Representative Barnhart, the first step we need to do is describe the vision and unbundle the budget so you see where the money's going now and ask the question of ask the question that you were just asking: how much resource are we spending, not just in K-12, but in the high school, in the senior years of high school? Do we have adequate dollars per student to pay for the programs you want? The first step to answer that question is to unbundle the budget. And if you don't unbundle the budget and really understand where the dollars are going and what the performance of the current system looks like, you cannot easily answer that question. My guess is, you know, where we are today, given the recession, is there is not enough resource. But before you try to answer that, you've got to get good budget information, and you've got to understand the gaps in the system where we're frankly not spending money wisely, and we're not getting the performance we need, and there we need to take corrective action so we can move students more smoothly and rapidly through the system. So it's not a simple answer to say it's more money. It's about system redesign. It's about the redesign of this institution, as I've said before, so that you're focusing on a new budget model that really creates the incentives and the expectations for the kind of results you were talking about this morning. Now, we could talk the rest of the day, and I know there are a lot of people after me, so I don't think we should, I'm happy to come back and talk further. I think it's a huge issue. I agree with the issue. What I really wanted to say, though, is the fact is there are a lot of adults right now without the skills to be successful in the economy we find ourselves. They're underemployed, they're unemployed, they're transitional workers, and they're going to be in the work, they're going to be adults for a long time, and if we don't find strategies to get, if we don't find strategies to help them get to where they need to be, we're going to lose that generation too. So while we fix the system, we need to focus on that issue, and that's what this bill does. And just briefly, because there are many more after me, I'm sorry. It's probably the state board. Excuse me. Illegal. So the bill basically is a targeted effort. The OWEB board, working with the governor's office, a relatively small piece of the education continuum budget to focus on that need, and then the idea is to tie. The training to a skill certificate that we'll be talking at the state board this morning about that CAM is putting together that will deal with the skill levels we were talking about earlier, both for high school and try to connect those skill levels so we have a common understanding of what it takes to be successful in the economy. It provides targeted resources to help that group through the workforce board to help that group get the skills they need tied to high demand occupations. There is a huge need, I can tell you, for that training right now. And I will know, and the results will be a stronger economy, but more importantly, a lot of adults who have higher wage jobs, incomes that can support a family and provide the resources we need to support our communities. So, I would encourage you to realize this is a part of the larger continuum. And we went through the budget process this year, and I sat on the committee and the joint boards. We looked at all the various investment opportunities. This is one among many. And I understand Representative Riley's point really well, but I would just encourage you to realize there are a lot of adults right now who need these skills, and and this is a targeted program to address that need. As I know Cam will tell you, she's quite committed to doing research and evaluation on the program. As we see how this works, we'll be back to you and give you the opportunity to take a look at it. But I think it's an important part of the continuum we need to be working on. Thank you.
Duncan, thank you so very much. And I realize that you've taken time out of the State Ed Committee to come over here, and I appreciate your doing that. Committee members, I'm going to hold on the questions. I'm going to take Duncan up on his offer to come back.
I'd be happy to come back and talk further. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Norm.
Thank you very much, Chairman Witt, members of the committee. I, too, will be brief. It's a pleasure. Duncan left. It's a pleasure to share a panel with him unprepared because he's exactly on point. I'm here representing Manufacturing 21 Coalition. We've been before you before. It's nice to be here again. We support this measure. Skill Up Oregon Fund is an important response to the challenges that Duncan just laid out. It's been interesting to listen to the committee's discussion today, because it's been very reminiscent of the discussion that has occurred within the councils of the Manufacturing 21 Coalition. We are dealing with an enormously complex system, and some of you may remember from our previous testimony that we laid out a kind of template, an 8-point template for thinking about workforce. And one of those issues which we didn't highlight in our previous testimony, but was a call to reinvent professional technical education. I represent a bunch of engineers in many cases who are working for these manufacturing companies, and they think in two terms when they find a very complex challenge. They think about reinvention and imagineering. And our challenge to you would be, and this isn't something you're going to be able to deal with this session, that is Skill Up and other issues which are coming before you are absolutely needed. We strongly support them. You should take positive action on them. But you should also do as my father always advised when confused. Stand still for a moment. Step back. Take a deep breath and say, let's get ready for 08. Let's take a look at this system, which is enormously complex, which has many, many moving parts, everybody trying to do a very good job, and figure out how we re-engineer it, how we reimagine it, so that it does the things that I've heard you express this morning. I think there's broad consensus across the state, among business, industry, labor, the institutions that support them, that it's time to take a look at how we piece all these things together. Individual responses, I think are critical, but they are just that. They're individual responses to a much larger challenge. The larger challenge is how we reimagine our professional technical education system. And that means being creative, and I'm not here to suggest answers because I think this is, we don't have any. We have ideas, but we don't have solutions, comprehensive solutions. I think it's time that we take that deep breath, take a step back, and I think our members would be very supportive of that during the interim. So our message is Skill Up Fund, terrific, let's do it. We think it's a very important measure, but we also think that the broader questions that you clearly have mucked around in today are things you should continue to muck around in, and we encourage you to do that. Thank you.
Thank you so very, very much, Norm. Appreciate your comments. I'd just like to recognize that we have in the audience Commissioner Brawley and Director Warner, and if the two of you wouldn't mind, I'm going to try and accommodate the schedule of folks who've traveled a great distance here today to be with us. Nan, Poppy, do you have a group of folks to bring up?
Yeah, I think you guys want to go first.
Okay. Chuck's up first. Good morning and welcome.
My name is Chuck. The protocol is, I should say, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chuck Forster, and I'm Executive Director of the Lane Workforce Partnership. We are the local workforce board in Lane County. And there are three of us here to speak to the value of training and how a partnership really works and how the kind of resources that Skill Up will provide will really allow us to continue to expand our training of high-wage individuals, in our case, in Lane County.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Kuntz, and I'm the Workforce Development Coordinator for Peace Health Oregon Region, Peace Health Faislaw Region, and Cottage Grove Hospital, which is a little bit south of Eugene. And I don't know, do you want to introduce yourself before I start?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Mary Spilde. I'm president of Lane Community College in Eugene.
Thank you both.
Peace Health Oregon Region is the largest employer in Lane County. We have about 4,600 employees. Peace Harbor Hospital in Florence is the largest employer in Florence with about 480 employees. We have been in a partnership with our local workforce investment board and our local one-stop for about 4 years, and that partnership has grown significantly. The good news is the use of the funds has enabled us to match up the money that we're putting in as an employer with the money that we can access through the federal funds, so that we have people in a pipeline that are continuously moving up from low-wage jobs, low-skilled jobs into professions such as nursing, radiology, pharmacy, physical therapy, and the like. You all know of workforce shortages. You all know of labor shortages. You all know the nursing shortage. I could go on and on and on and don't want to spend the time on that. But in essence, this is crucial. We, as an organization, put over $500,000 on a yearly basis into our employees and into our local community college. What I'm saying is we're doing a lot, and it's not enough. The upcoming shortages that we're expecting, although we have been artificially harbored from that for the last few years because of our partnership with our local community college and the work that they're doing, that is going away. The winds are clearing, and the hurricane is coming on strong, and we're feeling that as we prepare to build a new hospital and as we see the growth of the community and of course, all the changes with baby boomers and what's expected to be the demand on healthcare into the future. So use of Skill Up funds, In essence, would complement what we're currently doing, and it would be great. But as we move forward, when we look in the next year, 2 years, 3 years, it's going to be a survival tool for us as a large employer. We use this money in partnership with the additional money that we offer through our own funds. We have case managers that come on site that meet with our employees. We facilitate the connections that they make, so that employees can utilize those funds. As an employer, when we offer an employee funds in order for that money to not be taxable to the employee, we have to put significant limitations on how any of that money can be used, and it's very specific to only tuition and fees and direct educational costs. We cannot use that money to support household expenses, to support loss in wages because they're going to school, transportation, child care, those types of things, where our partnership with our Workforce Investment Board and the One Stop has allowed the employees to receive support in those areas, and so it really has been critical. And I can't say enough about how important it is that the money be available and that the industry partners be at the table and that the community college is at the table. I don't think that we could do the work that we have done and that we could do the work that has to be done in the future without that. And I came prepared to give some stories. I could go on and on. I could give you dozens and dozens of stories about people that have used these funds and where it's gotten them and the wage progressions that they've seen. In the interest of time, I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to pass it over to Mary and let her talk a little bit.
Thank you, Kathleen. Chair Witt, members of the committee, I will be brief just to say that I think in Lane County we have a very strong partnership. And we're talking about health care because when you look at the employment trends in Lane County, it's health care, and health care in terms of high-wage jobs. And so we've developed these partnerships with the Workforce Board and our hospitals to make sure that we're doing everything we can to meet the need. To be honest, any community college president in their right mind would not be offering a nursing program because that and dental hygiene are our most expensive programs, and if we were just looking at things from a financial standpoint, we wouldn't be doing it. But clearly, that's where the jobs are, so we must do it. But it does mean with the tuition increases that students have seen over the last few years because of the lack of state funding, that it's increasingly difficult for low-wage workers to access these high-demand programs. And so between the Pell Grant, the Opportunity Grant, the workforce money, and now with this skill-up money, it really becomes feasible for students to put a package together where they can access these high-wage, high-demand jobs. And something like nursing or dental hygiene, respiratory therapy, these really are the jobs where people can take the leap from poverty to the middle class with a two-year degree, and that doesn't happen in very many areas. So we're just very much in support of that and really feel that these local partnerships will make it work. Thank you.
Mary, thank you so very, very much. And the chair would note that in addition to Kathleen's advocacy and work in workforce development, she knows of what she speaks. She is also a nurse herself. Mm-hmm. Thank you all very, very much for appearing today. I certainly appreciate it. And thank you, too, Mary, for the emphasis on a pathway for low-skilled workers into high-skill, high-wage jobs.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, if I could just add that the discussion that you had earlier, I have a lot to say about that, too, in terms of the kinds of things we've been doing in Lane County with the Regional Technical Education Consortium to hook up with high schools to assure that students who are not engaged by a college prep class actually do have access to the kinds of shop classes or the hands-on experiences that will lead them into a pathway to these kinds of jobs that we were talking about earlier. So I will provide some information about that to the committee. It's just another example of the creative kinds of solutions that are actually going on in local communities.
Thank you so very, very much. Nan? Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Witt, I've been elected to go first. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Andrew McGough, and I'm the Executive Director of Work Systems, Inc., which is the Workforce Investment Board for the City of Portland, Washington, and Multnomah Counties. And just as sort of in my casual observation sitting back there, I just wanted to say, as a citizen of Oregon, as a person who has a kid in the public schools, I'm really heartened by the breadth of the conversation that you all are undertaking. I think that this is an incredibly important issue. It is also very complicated, and I'm really, again, very impressed by the breadth of the conversation that's
you all are leading, and I hope that at any time we can provide input. I'm very happy to do that. So I don't want to belabor a lot of other things that I know you've heard that people have talked about. I might just add a couple things. Our support for 2206 is about, you know, sort of immediate needs. We have a lot of people who we think want to get into high-skilled, high-wage jobs, but they need assistance now in order to be prepared to do that and to do that successfully. 40% of the workers that we served in our dislocated worker programs last year, that's about 3,000 people, 40% spoke English as a second language. Two out of three people that enter our local community college system require some form of remediation before they can be successful in post-secondary education. So there's a tremendous need out there. And it costs money to move people from low skills to high skills. We do receive federal resources to do that. And some local resources, but those dollars are rapidly diminishing. The federal government invests about 11% today of what it invested in 1970. So the resources are diminishing. They're difficult to manage because they're complicated and, frankly, often very inflexible, and people don't understand sort of the complexity of those rules and what it means when you try to serve people. So I think 2206 is an absolutely great idea, one that's absolutely needed. I would just encourage that you offer local communities the flexibility to package that money in the way that it makes most sense with what's available at the regional level, because there are other resources, and we can put together packages that provide the breadth of service that people really need to move from point A to point F or wherever it is you want to take them. And just as a final comment before I hand it over to Christine, I just want to say that we view going to work and going to college as being one and the same. So we're very eager to do whatever we can to prepare people to be successful in whatever profession they choose to undertake. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew. Christine, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here today to in support of your legislation, and also wanted to briefly tell my story and how I've benefited from the funding that's been available for me to get some continuing education. Shortly before I turned 52 years old, my position at the Oregon Historical Society, which I held for over 18 years, was eliminated. While I was the director of the IT department, the Information Technology Department, I basically ran the department but did not have any specific skills relating to network operation, et cetera, security, things like that. So when I was put out into the workforce, I quickly realized that in order to secure another position, although, you know, I knew I would not make what I was making at the Oregon Historical Society, that my skills were considerably lacking and in the technology aspect. So I chose to kind of market myself based on my management skills. As the oldest of five children, way back when, before color television, I was not allowed the opportunity to go to college, so therefore I do not have a bachelor's degree. So I quickly realized that because I got involved and was certified as a dislocated worker, I was able to look for getting a credential or some kind of piece of paper to go on my resume that would add credibility to the management positions of which I've been applying for. So I was going to start in spring term. I was going to start with one of the career pathways programs on management, and I fell off a curb in Canada and broke my foot. So for 3 months, I spent a lot more time contemplating my future and my life, and so I decided that when June rolled around that I would go to enroll in the Career Pathways program in the accounting, because I felt that more accounting knowledge, which I was building on in my past, would help me in my future job search. So I did go through my first term, got a certificate, and I landed a job working as a church administrator for the First United Methodist Church in Portland, Oregon, which is also allowing me to use the skills that I've learned through the accounting program and building on what I already had. I would like to say that I really am in favor of this legislation, and if there's one thing I've learned through my whole process, almost 11 months, is that the only thing that we have as far as job security is our skills, and we need to make sure that we continue to build on them. And I think this legislation will allow people to be able to take their skills and to build on them, especially those who are forced into a situation that is not of their making when they're forced to go out and look for another job again. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nan Poppy, and I'm one of the campus presidents at Portland Community College. And thank you for allowing us to share with you a few moments. You know, time is very brief, and let me just make some summary comments. You know, at its very simplest, what this bill would do would allow us as a state to make an investment along this educational continuum that we've all been talking about to begin to tackle some of the issues of this perfect storm that is just about to hit or has started to hit. We have most of the people who are going to be in the labor market in the next 40 years are already in the labor market, and many of them are just not able to be globally competitive. We have many, many more who are unemployed.
Ian, let me interrupt just for a moment. If you can back away from the mic just a little.
Sorry. And so these unemployed people, and then people who are in the labor market but not able to get a family wage job because of their skill level really need an investment of training and education. This is a bill that will allow us to put some more money in that training fund in our WorkSource centers so people who come to us who want to go into apprenticeship but they can't qualify because they don't speak English or because they don't have the math and technical skills, we'll be able to give them pre-apprenticeship training to get them ready. People who need basic skills remediation will get it. Also, we'll be able, as Andrew said, to package the various funds so that a lot of people who really want training but aren't able to put the whole package together will be able to get it. So I really encourage you to support this bill. All the community colleges are very much in favor of it. And I think we want to allow some time for questions, so I'll stop there.
Okay. Just to help me manage my time, are there other folks in the audience who didn't have an opportunity to sign up but would like to testify today? One, two. Okay. Just a brief couple of questions, committee members, if you have them. Yes, Representative Holby.
Well, and this is, goes to the last couple of panels that have been up here, but I'm going to make it very short. You know, and I really support this Skill Up Oregon, and I really support it, you know, trying to accomplish all the goals that we've talked about before. And I got to tell you, the nursing thing, as we've heard, is really one of the biggest train wreck we're looking at is the medical profession. So it really frustrates me that our community college budget is so short that our community colleges really don't have the capacity to meet the needs that we see at this committee level. And I hope some of this money goes directly to helping them with their nursing programs. And if it were me making amendments to this bill, I would probably earmark that money for the regional boards to go to to the nursing program and help the community colleges train nurses. But, you know, so it makes me nervous a little bit when we'll provide this flexibility that everybody wants. And it makes me nervous because at the end of the day, I don't know whether that money's going to go to the nursing program that we see the need that needs to be addressed. So I guess there's a lot of trust going down the path to our local regional boards that they recognize the focus that really needs to happen out there. So I guess I'll just end with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Holvey.
Yeah, Representative Holvey, and Mr. Chair, if I could comment on that. I think one of the things this bill does is make sure that the money gets targeted at high-wage, high-demand growth areas. So I think that, you know, obviously all health care is on that list.
And I guess I would also add, too, Representative Povey, that we have very sophisticated mechanisms to track what people receive out of these resources, and we'd be happy to share those.
Thank you very much for that offer. Panel, appreciate your coming today, and certainly appreciate your comments. Thank you so very much. Could I invite our last two witnesses up to come up together and just probably expedite things that, in that fashion?
Hey, how are you?
Great.
Good morning, and thank you both for coming.
And good morning, Chair Witt and committee members. I definitely am going to be brief. As a matter of fact, my organization, because I talk so much, said, Jerry, please promise that you will read your statement, your testimony. So with that, first of all, I'd like to thank you for providing me with this opportunity to come today and be in support of the Skill Up Oregon. My name is Jerry Washington. I'm the lead organizer for Oregon Action. We are a community-based organization dedicated to the empowerment of people from all walks of life, especially those who oftentimes find themselves on the downside of power. We represent over 6,500 members, mostly low-income and people of color. One of the barriers that many of our members face when looking for work that pays is the lack of training for a living wage job. The Skill Up Oregon Fund will help thousands of Oregonians support their families by putting these higher wage jobs within reach. Our organization works in partnership with Northwest Federation of Community Organizations to provide an annual living wage report, of which some of our members personally dropped off at each of the, I know we got to the state representatives, we almost got completely through the Senate House, but if you don't have a copy, I'll be more than happy to provide you with that copy. The study found that a living wage range in Oregon is from $11.38 an hour for a single adult to $22.34 for a single parent with two children. Our most recent study uses those living wage figures to figure out how well Oregon economy is doing in providing jobs that pay those wages. The results are discouraging, as you pretty well know, and it shows that living wage job openings are few and far between. There are as many as 20 times as many job seekers as there are job openings that pay a living wage for a family. We support the Skill Up Oregon Fund because it will help many families get the skills they need to be competitive in such a tight job market. Also, a more skilled applicant pool will likely result in a higher wage overall as companies compete for these newly trained workers. As skills go up, we should also see increases in the number of available living wage jobs that we want Oregonians to be able to fill. An additional amendment that Oregon Action would like to propose to the Skill Up Oregon is that the Oregon Workforce Investment Board measures the effectiveness of the funds by keeping records on the number of available living wage jobs. Our study has shown that currently there are very few openings that pay a wage a family can really live on. By increasing the skill levels of job applicants, the Skill Up Oregon Fund should also increase the number of available living wage jobs. It is important that our state keep track of this progress to inform any future policies with regards to living wage jobs. And with that, I'd just like to thank you again for the opportunity to be here on behalf of Oregon Action.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Duke Shepherd with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I've written testimony, so I will just go with about three sentences of it, if that's all right. We believe the bill does more than just help groups of job seekers to get jobs. It invests in providing skills that are transferable across multiple occupations and will really contribute to upward mobility, particularly for those folks who may have already not had success in the labor market, but could with some significant or even in some cases slight upgrade. I would add that the data-driven targeted focus on specific industry clusters contemplated in the bill will ensure that the jobs being filled are well-paying jobs with good benefits and real upward mobility. If the state's going to make investments in workforce training, this bill is the kind of investment you should pursue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Duke. That was a record.
I'm to please. Thanks.
And your appearance is much appreciated. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House Bill 2206 today? With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on the bill and briefly open a work session on the same bill, only to mention that the Dash 2 amendments are not back from Legislative Council at this point. And, Commissioner, I think what I'll do is have you do the Dash 1s and 2s together when they're all ready. I'm getting an affirmative nod, and with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2206, and it appears that our committee has finished its agenda for today, and I want to thank the audience ever so much for making it possible for me to bring this gavel down in a timely fashion today. It's much appreciated. With that, we stand adjourned. Have a good weekend, everyone.